In this second hour of Midday, we continue to hear different perspectives on Freddie Gray's neighborhood, Sandtown Winchester in West Baltimore. Among our guests, Kurt L. Schmoke, now the president of the University of Baltimore. Kurt Schmoke was mayor of the city when Baltimore experienced the crack cocaine epidemic, and when the visionary developer James Rouse, the man who gave us Columbia and Harbor Place, launched his multi-million dollar effort to bring affordable housing to Sandtown Winchester. Where did that effort succeed and where did it fail in raising the quality of life of Sandtown's residents? Will the Freddie Gray tragedy spark a restart? Please stay tuned. More on Freddie's neighborhood coming up on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. In this hour, we continue our conversation on Baltimore's Sandtown Winchester neighborhood, the neighborhood where Freddie Gray grew up, a neighborhood that a part of town profoundly affected by poverty, unemployment, incarceration, drug abuse, and violence. Later this hour, former Mayor Kurt Schmoke, now president of the University of Baltimore, will be joining us because he was mayor and worked alongside James Rouse, the visionary developer, to rebuild Sandtown Winchester back in the 1990s. Staying over with us in this hour of the show, Carol Reckling, who is a member of BUILD, Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development, and has been a partner with the Enterprise Foundation of the city in the redevelopment of Sandtown from the 1990s. So, Carol, thanks again for staying with us here.
Thank you, Dan.
Yeah, and Reverend Dr. Lewis Wilson of New Song Community Church in Sandtown Winchester with us again for this hour of the show. So nice to have you.
Glad to be here.
Before we go on, Chris Conley of the WYPR News Department is back from a press conference held by Governor Larry Hogan of Maryland, not in Annapolis, but it is the governor's office. I said Annapolis earlier, but actually in the governor's office here in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
So we noted that he announced that the lifting of the state of emergency, Chris.
Yeah, he said he's lifted the state of emergency. He said all of the National Guard and extra law enforcement assets that were deployed here have been pulled out of the city at this point. Earlier today, he also said that he was going to release money for state workers to get a cost of living adjustment. That had been an issue during the session. He noted that today is State Worker Day. And he said it sort of today as he was praising, you know, both his staff and the state, you know, employee workforce in general for their response. He was really effusive with the praise about, you know, the state government people really kind of hitting the ground running and trying to make things work, and sort of this, the whole list of agencies that have been trying to coordinate to help people respond to both, you know, rebuilding after the damage that came on Monday, but, you know, addressing other issues in general. He said that he loves Baltimore. He said that he pointed to sort of longstanding problems and said he wants to work to fix them. He said it won't take, you know, it won't be immediate, the fix, but he's appointed Boyd Rutherford, the lieutenant governor, to sort of help coordinate the city and state agencies working together, you know, for the immediate recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he's also leaning on Kiefer Mitchell as an advisor. He's the former Baltimore delegate to ties to a pretty famous civil rights family.
Sure, now special advisor to the governor.
Now special advisor to the governor.
Did the government commit any money to the immediate recovery?
He didn't exactly. He said that he's pulling $20 million out of the rainy day fund. And he didn't say exactly how it's going to be spent. I think some of it is going to be used to cover, you know, just the bringing in the National Guard and sort of all of the deployment over the last week. But I imagine some of that will also go towards responding. He sort of said we're still assessing the costs and the needs. And so, you know, we're pulling this out essentially to have some extra money to work with.
No special session of the General Assembly expected in the wake of this?
No, I don't think
there
that's going to happen.
There have been calls for it.
The legislature did, however, appoint a new task force to study essentially community and policing relationships. Kurt Anderson was at the press conference just as an observer, but, you know, was there, and I chatted with him for a little bit.
He's a delegate. He's co-chairing this task force?
Exactly. He's co-chairing it with Senator Pugh. And he's said that, you know, there's going to be a lot of focus on the Law Enforcement Bill of Rights and reforms there. He says that they need to make it more transparent when police officers are being tried for misconduct. You know, people should be able to see that process in action. And right now, a lot of it happens behind closed doors. There are also a couple of other task forces sort of related. There's one on body cameras that the legislature's looking at how to implement body cameras. And then another one looking at sort of reinvestment, you know, criminal justice reinvestment, how to look at the data on recidivism and sort of find data-driven strategies to reduce both recidivism and, you know, kind of get at some of the spending money on criminal justice system kind of in better ways and
right.
sort of earlier instead on of having instead of at the tail end.
A revolving door at the prisons, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I did ask the governor, I should say, there's this bit of money for public education that has been earmarked by the legislature, but the governor has it's up to him to release it. This is GCEI money, the Geographic Cost of Education Index,
right.
that sort of gives extra money to districts like Baltimore that are more expensive to run schools in. I asked him if the last, you know, couple weeks have made him think that maybe it's worth releasing that money. And he said that he hadn't heard from people about education formulas when he was out there. He said people talked about rec centers and they talked about jobs. So he said it kind of has no bearing. I asked Delegate Anderson what he thought of that, and he said he understands where the governor's coming from. Obviously, he would like to see more money go into the public schools here. But he said, you know, there's also ways that we should probably look at to kind of make sure we're being more efficient in the way we're spending money, and also kind of look at things like job training, job placement, et cetera.
Very good. Thank you very much, Chris.
Sure thing.
Chris Connolly, the WYPR news staff. Interesting comment from the governor. Actually, I have heard other people and have seen tweets and social media comments about releasing that final bit of money was some $200 million, I think, in education funds that were held up there at the end of the legislative session. Chris just mentioned recidivism, you know, inmates returning to the prison system within 3 years. That's the rate here in Maryland used to be in the 60s. It's now in the 40s. It's, you know, there's been some improvements in the state already. But that's one of your focuses in Sandtown, Winchester, Reverend Wilson, right?
Yes, it is. Again, you've had on Elder Antoine Bennett, and he works directly with those, as we say, returning citizens.
Mm-hmm. And Elder Harris, C.W. Harris,
yes,
who puts in the work on his hoop
right,
gardens, right?
Right.
Hoop houses.
I was just at a conference. A friend of mine invited me from AMI, who serves with as a consultant with the legislators who deal with justice, criminal justice in Washington, D.C. And, you know, they're now giving earned credits for people who take certain courses in prisons, and they get earned credits, which comes off their time,
mm-hmm.
which comes off their time. And so that but the goal is that they are better prepared to engage the local job markets. One of the things that we've begun to think through and decide that we need to engage in what we call developmental entrepreneurship and look at the strengths of people. We tend to look at Sandtowns if people don't have strengths. It takes a lot of creativity if you got a habit, a heroin habit or a crack habit or definitely a cocaine habit to gather hundreds of dollars a day. You have to be very creative. You have to be kind of a workaholic. And
if you're a dealer, you got to be an entrepreneur, right?
You have to be an entrepreneur.
You
got to
know how to hustle.
So
right?
It's not that people do not have skills that come out of prison or who are involved in criminality. The question is we don't design things and even businesses that can tap into that kind of creativity. Because you're right, it's been mentioned by a number of your speakers today, to employ people in a job that a robot could displace them 2 weeks from now is not helpful. that may be a starting point, but we do live in a capitalist society. You have to look at what skills are going to be here today and tomorrow. There are things that we can do creatively in terms of helping people start some small shops, which is the rave now in terms of being entrepreneurial, where they can get a foot in the door and not only have sufficient incomes, but also can employ other people in the community.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because just yesterday on the program, one of our guests, Ron Kreitner, suggested a revival or re-energizing or refunding the shopsteading program that went on here in Baltimore, would help people set up small shops, small businesses in the city.
Absolutely.
Tessa Hill Aston is with us also today, president of the Baltimore chapter of the NAACP. The NAACP National established an office in Santa, or no, the Baltimore.
Baltimore City branch.
Nice to have you with us,
yes,
Tessa.
Yes, Baltimore City branch
I'm sorry. I want to get that straight. So you established an office in Santa, but you're very familiar with Santa because actually you used to work there.
Yes, I used to work at Gilmore Homes as an acting manager, and I was there for quite a while. I helped to establish and reestablish a tenant council president. Every housing development is supposed to have a tenant council. And when I got there, they didn't have one active, so I helped to reestablish that. And I'm happy to say that the lady who was the president then had just got reelected, and she's the president currently right now. So I'll be working very closely with her in the community. I met with the manager of Gilmore yesterday. There's over 580 units there, which means that's over 580 families that have a lease there, that live there, homes. And so we will be working with the community.
So you decided to open office there in the midst of all the problems last week.
Yes. The first day that when the first day last Sunday, almost 10 days ago, we decided at the Baltimore branch that we could go there and drive there and walk around. But I decided that it would be best for us to physically be housed there to do the kind of work that's necessary. And so far it's working. And next week we will be kicking off with more than over 50 volunteer attorneys from all sources of Baltimore that are giving us their time to help with expungements. And we'll be doing individual expungement, and we'll be doing clinics for people to come in and get their records clean. And that's the first start.
You got 50 volunteer attorneys lined up for that?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Hey, since you mentioned that, that's great. You mentioned Gilmore Homes. I want to ask you about this. Some people look at public housing and assume it's trouble, that's a generator of trouble in the communities. I have found in my lifetime in Baltimore, the high rises used to be notorious for that.
Yes.
And that the low rises didn't quite have that problem.
Yeah.
Not to that extent. And the city, the housing authority, put a lot of effort into renovating those places.
Yes.
They're necessary.
You mentioned that you'll have former Mayor Kurt Smoke. I worked for Kurt Smoke very closely during his administration, and I actually was the point person to do the implosion of the high-rises. And it's more than just crime that they were they're gone. Also, that they were old. The elevators would be breaking all the time, which cost a lot of money. And, you know, nowadays, let's just say a family of three young ladies in a house, in an apartment, in a high-rise, they blow-drying, they have technology. The buildings couldn't do what we needed for new technology because of the wiring and the plumbing, so things had to change. The low-rises and family places like McCullough Homes and Gilmore
Perkins have not had
they get a lot of bad rap, but it's beautiful and wonderful people who've lived there for years that raise their children. A lot of times when there's been a lockup, and especially back when I was there, we had our own housing authority police. They did community policing because they knew their people. And a lot of times when it was crime on the premises, on the property of, let's say, Gilmore, the person that was apprehended was not necessarily a resident. They were passing through. So they get blamed for things because if someone gets locked up, they say, oh, it got happened at Gilmore Homes, but it wasn't necessarily a Gilmore resident.
Tessa, before you go today, I was curious what you think about the commentary or the narrative on Sandtown Winchester, that it's become a failure. You know, we sort of started off this way, and our guests on the show are trying to correct some of that and say, yeah, well, this isn't so great, but this is. We did establish new housing there and home ownership there and haven't had a lot of failures over the years when it comes to that. But yet there's still all these other problems that I mentioned, unemployment. There are health problems with people Sandtown Winchester. So what do you say to people when they say it's a failure?
I think it has been wonderful things that have developed, wonderful programs like New Psalm. I think the St. Gregory's, the church, has been wonderful outreach. The priest that was there for years, everyone knew him. Next door to St. Gregory's is a new senior citizen building that is run by a commissional agent through the health department. So it's lots of good things, but unfortunately the news and people do not do the good stuff. If sometimes we have sent a flyer out to say that it's going to be a graduation of a GED program, that New Psalm was going to be doing something, maybe the media doesn't show up, but they show up when there's violence. So we don't get attention in some of these neighborhoods. Just like right now, the lawyers that have come to me and say they want to volunteer, they said, what can I do to help? Because they didn't know things were that bad. Yes, it's a lot of blight. I went talk to a lady yesterday. She lives in a block. She's the only person in a block of about 10 houses. The rest of the houses are vacant. There's a you can walk up one street and you see all these beautiful homeowners on Lawrence Street in Calhoun, people planting flowers, having cookouts, the grills in the yard. They live in wonderfully. But then you go three blocks around the corner, there's some vacant houses and some whole blocks are vacant. When there's vacancy, people, homeless people, drug people will migrate to that area. If we change that and put flowers and adopt a block, and if it's a vacant house next to a house, the city will even let you adopt it to use it as something you could use. So there's some good things going on. We just need to fix the bad stuff.
You know, the city has this vacancy-to-value program under this administration, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake. Hasn't it reached parts of Sandtown yet, or is the market just not interested in those houses? Can anyone comment on that? Carol?
I think that there is, when you think about a community that you're going to adopt in that way, you're looking for, as we said, you're looking for where's the nearest supermarket? Where am I going to do my shopping? Where can my children play? What school is in the community? And so these are the things that people are looking for. And that this is why I'm saying that the organized citizens have to demand these kinds of things. And for as long as I've been in Build, I know we were looking at the recreation centers. Whenever I saw children interviewed on the news during the uprising, I never saw one who didn't say there's no rec center. I was amazed because you had someone on yesterday talking about a survey that no one mentioned it. I'm like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, Bill Henry, the city councilman.
No, it wasn't him.
It was Bill. And I wonder what kind of survey was that that didn't include that?
We've talked to thousands of people.
It's hard to believe it.
And believe me, jobs is always number one. But recreation, what happens after school and their schools, this is so important to people.
Reverend Wilson?
Yeah, one of the things, and it was commented on in terms of Pennsylvania Avenue. Well, again, I'm from Chicago, but Chicago had what was Martin Luther King, which was, I forgot what the street was named now. And you go 125th Street in Harlem. Every African-American neighborhood had these very solid neighborhoods that were the hub historically. But the cultural difference was, and people won't like this, integration almost hurt us. It took our doctors, it took our lawyers, it took our educators who at one time lived in the same community that we did. So you had a role model. You had somebody to look at who got up and went to work every day and who, quote-unquote, became successful in some other enterprise. So there was always a dream. In some kind of way, we got to recast that dream.
Tessa? Yeah.
Well, you know, Reverend Wilson is absolutely correct. I would almost say except for people who lived on the east side, mostly every family has someone in their family, a grandmother or aunt, that came out of the Sandtown Gilmore. My mother was born in Sandtown. My grandmother died in her 90s at Gilmore. So there's people who now have arrived and gone across the line of living in another area, and they have the right to do that. But I think giving back and caring and seeing what they can do to help, if it's no more than donating $1 or $2 or $5 to some of these programs that are already in Sandtown. Just this morning when I got there, Joe Jones from the Center for Urban Families stopped by to see me. What can I do? He's going to give me one of his staff persons to sit in the Gilmore office next week. The mayor and some of the health department will be giving people to sit in the office. So everybody's trying to help. We just need to do a concentrated area effort to do more quick fix of the people so that we can have a better community in their lives.
I want to take a couple of calls here before we take our break, because on the other side of the break, we'll be speaking with former Mayor Kurt Schmoke. Saeed called back. I'm glad you did, because you wanted to make a point here. Saeed, thanks.
Sure. The first point that I would love to make is that none of these programs are only single persons or organizations' failure. It is Baltimore's failure, Maryland's failure, and also United States' failure. There is a good document about a brief history of public housing in United States written by A.J. Stoloff. and it shows how people, actually poor people, were concentrated in certain cities by building these public housings, and how some who had a white skin could get out of this situation, and the blacks actually could not. Overall, is that you have huge concentration of poor people in Baltimore, and it is not only Sandtown, it is all over different neighborhoods that we have concentration of poor. We have Midway, we have East Baltimore. It is overwhelming for any organization to be able to help every single one of these people.
All right, thank you, Saeed. Carol Reckling, when it comes to actually people who live in Sandtown, there's a high poverty rate, but not everyone is in poverty.
No,
and
as a matter of fact,
there's a lot of working poor.
Exactly, right. Exactly.
I heard this comment, that people who moved into the new housing in Sandtown were the people who could afford it, that this housing didn't serve people who were already living there.
No, that is not true. The people are first-time homeowners who would not have been able to purchase a home had Build not organized, thanks to Senator Mikulski, that we organized with to get $20,000 to $25,000 to buy down the mortgage on the homes, with the state, and at that time was Governor Schaefer, who brought down the mortgage rate that people had to pay.
Would you say that but for that program, a lot of those folks couldn't have afford those homes?
They absolutely couldn't, and they'll tell you that today.
Okay,
they're taxpayers.
I'm only bringing this up because but for question is also used to justify huge tax breaks for developers along the Baltimore waterfront. But for a huge tax break, this hotel would not be built. We have to take a break here. We'll come back and continue our conversation about Sandtown, Winchester. Tessa Hill Aston of the Baltimore NAACP, now with an office in back in Gilmore.
Yes.
Thank you very much for being here with us.
Thank you.
Please stay with us, folks. Former Mayor Kurt L. Schmoke will be joining us shortly as we continue our conversation about Sandtown Winchester. Let's take a call from Lou before we go on here. Lou, this is Midday. Thanks for calling. What did you want to say?
Hi, Dan. Thank you so much for taking my call. And let me just tell you who I am first. I own a company. It's On Demand Labor Baltimore, and I specialize in hiring people who are minimally skilled or have no skills at all. And usually they're low-income people, and they're usually black males who have a criminal record. So since this whole thing has happened here, I've been talking to the guys and girls that I send out, and I'll tell you exactly, this is the sentiment. Most of the people I've talked to have absolutely no trust for our politicians or those people who are supposed to correct the problems. I get constant questions like, where has the NAACP been? This mayor who fought for this Grand Prix, if she had fought for black males and females to have work, to reduce the density of liquor stores. They are just wondering, where has everyone been? And at this point, there is absolutely no trust. And I think that until that trust is regained or earned, you're not going to see any progress. I have employees who tell me that probably in July or August, this town will probably burn because they have this seething anger and mistrust. And I would just like to know how you all plan to get that trust that you absolutely must have before you can rebuild this city.
Okay, Lou, I just wonder, what makes them say that about July and August? What would set that off again?
Well, from what I understand, the heat, young people being out of schools, the frustration with not being able to enjoy time and entertainment with your families, with your friends, the idea that these young men in their communities, they go into their communities and they see crews of people working and none of them look like themselves. I'll give you an example. Johns Hopkins built a $1 billion hospital and there were very, very few black men and women working on that job. I remember complaining about that to our mayor, and I remember the frustration that happened then. And we still have developments that are happening, and we have absolutely no one fighting for these folks. The only way they get attention is by destroying things. And these young people, and it's the young people, because the older people have become so numb to this and so accepting of it. But this is the thing. This is the difference between Baltimore now and where Baltimore was in the past. In the past, there was always some glimmer of hope. At this point in Baltimore's history, our young people have absolutely no hope. And I speak to them every day. Mm. I take them out. I put them on job sites. I took a young fellow yesterday over to Baltimore City Community College, got him registered for school. This is a young man who had been shot as a drug dealer when he was young. I am so proud of him. But
well, there's some hope there, Lou, in that story.
But how many of these young people can I touch?
All right, Lou, I'm sorry, we got to go. But I appreciate what you're saying. What did you want to say, Reverend Wilson, about that?
I understand the caller's passion, but to say that, you know, they actually absolutely have no one, and you've had people around this table today. We have Marvin is a light in sand time.
Marvin Warfield has just arrived in the studio here. Marvin, nice to see you.
Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, Marvin Warfield actually lives in sand time.
That's right, born and raised.
We're supposed to talk to Mayor Schmoke, former Mayor Schmoke here. So let me take his phone call, Marvin. We'll come back and talk to you and see what that hope is that Reverend Wilson finds in you. So thank you for coming to our studio. Mm-hmm. But let me take a minute and hear from former Mayor Kurt L. Schmoke, now the president of the University of Baltimore. Kurt Schmoke was mayor when the Sandtown project got started at the initiative of James Rouse. Hey, thank you for joining us today, Mayor Schmoke.
Thank you, Dan.
Did you just heard that last call?
Well, I heard a little of it, and you know, I'm certainly sympathetic that a great deal has to be done by all of us. I mean, I don't think that there's one person or one institution that's going to solve this problem. This is each one of us, in our own way, taking a section of the problem and working on it and working in a sustained way. But just let me quickly respond to one comment that I've heard a great deal, which is that Sandtown had been a forgotten place by government. You recall, and many folks do, that in the 1990s, we worked on a multi-year program. It was called Community Building in Partnership. And it focused on Sandtown, and it focused on Sandtown for two reasons. One, it had among the highest incidences of poverty and crime in our city, but it also had a core of community leaders. There was the Sandtown Winchester Association, the churches, they had some block captains, they had the build organization. So even with all the problems, there were a core of leaders that we wanted to work with. And we had, of course, some outside money from the Enterprise Foundation of Jim Rouse. So over a period of time, new houses were built. The Pennsylvania Avenue public market was renovated as kind of a spur to economic development. The schools, we invested in that. And so there was a lot of work done. In fact, over $130 million invested in the community. The question is, and it's a question I've been asking myself, what happened after 1990, well, you know, I left office December of 99.
Right.
And, spent the next 12 years over in D.C. at the Howard University. So I can't tell you what happened between 99 and now, but the only thing I do know is that an investment in people and in infrastructure and buildings and things like that started there. Whether it was sustained or not is one of the questions that we have to ask ourselves before we start deciding where to invest to deal with the problems now.
That voice you heard expressing, and others have expressed, you know, anger at the police, one thing, but long festering issues, especially among African-American young men in Baltimore City. This goes beyond Sandtown, Winchester.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, what are you hearing when you hear that?
Well, the one of the things that really troubles me, continues, and has troubled our community for a long time, is this kind of a subculture of violence that's there. And that can't just be attributed to outside people. I mean, look, just last week, with all the military and, you know, National Guard and state police and everybody that we had, we still had, what, 8 or 9 homicides?
Yes.
In our community. So, you know, when we look at that, those are the types of issues that we have to work on as a community, and not just, you know, look to others outside of our community to try to solve. So it's a combination of things. You know, it's, this, to me, is not the time to point fingers. This is the time to figure out how can each of us join together in some complementary fashion, whether it's the mayor doing a summer jobs program or the business community doing more investment, you know, whether it's school system having programs for the summer, recreation. I mean, there's a lot of things that we can do individually to work on this problem and make sure that we sustain it, not just in the summer, but beyond.
This is one important key point I wanted to ask you about, Kurt Schmoke. When you came into office, by then, the federal government had started to retreat from its investment in cities in terms of granting money to cities for various projects, street improvement projects, vacant house program, all those innovations that occurred during the time of your predecessor, Du Burns and William Donald Schaefer, and that money started to go away. That is a big deal when it comes to this.
That was, but you know, they did a couple of things that did benefit the community. First, they allowed the city and community, the public housing residents, to take a different approach to public housing. So, as you know, we tore down the four massive public housing projects that had become real warehouses of poverty and attractions for crime. That was huge. And put in nicer homes, different types of neighborhoods to improve the quality of life for the people in public housing. That was a big thing. The second, the Empowerment Zone program that occurred during the Clinton administration allowed us to make investments in three different areas of the city, but where you see it, if you're just looking at it visually now, the place that has benefited most has been Inner Harbor East and Canton. That's where, you know, that was part of the Empowerment Zone. So physically that was transformed. You don't see the physical transformation in some of the other areas. But we did have some resources, but clearly not as much as in the mid-60s and early 70s.
Thank you very much for being with us today.
Okie-do.
Yeah, nice to talk to you again. Kurt L. Schmoke, former mayor of Baltimore, now the president of the University of Baltimore. We should take a break here. This is the Midday Show. We're talking about Sandtown, Winchester. When we get back, Marvin Warfield will be joining us to talk about life in Sandtown and also what he experienced last week during the riots that flared up on Monday. You're welcome to join us with questions or comments, 410-662-8780, the Midday email address, midday@wypr.org. We'll be right back. So if you want to meet Pastor Lewis Wilson of New Song Community Church, it's 1530 Pressman Street. Very interesting spelling of Pressman, P-R-E-S-S-T-M-A-N, was something I learned as a young reporter years ago. It's at 11 a.m. on Sunday. And Reverend Wilson, is something you wanted to say about what Kurt Schmoke had to say just then?
Yeah, I think every dime that has been spent relative to jobs, relative to providing health care services, relative to constructing homes and providing mortgages ought to have been done and should continue to be done in a bigger and greater way. However, if we don't begin to actually spend time with one-on-one, face-to-face with these young black men, and that's personnel intensive, that's time intensive, and that's not where the big bucks come in. Nobody cares. It's easy for me to point to a building. I can say, oh, look, I built 10 homes. Mm-hmm. It may take me 5 years to turn one man around. that's time intensive. And I'm saying we need to spend some time with these men, guys like Marvin, spending time with people that he grew up with, that he has FaceTime with.
Marvin Moorfield is 29 years old, born and raised in Sandtown. Marvin, nice to have you on the show again. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You went to Gilmore Elementary?
Yeah.
And then you went to the New Song School, the academy?
For middle school.
Right. And then where'd you go to high school?
High school, I went to French Camp Academy in Mississippi.
How'd you end up in Mississippi for high school? Was that a long story?
Yeah, that's a long story.
Okay. But you graduated from high school in Mississippi and came back here?
Yes.
And did you go to college? Or?
I didn't finish, but I went to college, community college at Cecil Community.
Cecil County. County,
yeah.
Huh. And last Monday, before we go on to talk to you a little bit about life in Sandtown and what Reverend Wilson was just talking about, could you tell us about last Monday, your experience at Mrs. Grace's store? This is a corner grocery store?
Yeah, Grace Corner Store is a corner store that we have there, and Grace's family. Grace is the community. She helps out so many kids and so many families, like if they don't have the resources, she'll help you out and she'll work with you. And I noticed that the street was just billowing with smoke, and I have family right next to Grace Store, and I see the smoke, and I go down to see who it is, and I see that it's Grace Store. So a family member and I, our first thoughts was, we got to save the community. We got to save Miss Grace. So I see a fire extinguisher laying out there in front of her store, and I go inside the store, and I try to put out the small fires that we've seen. And he had a water hose that he brought from his house, and we just was in the fire all week.
Were you able to stop the fire?
No, we wasn't. She lost everything.
Oh, really? Where is that store, Marvin?
The store's on Mountain Baker.
Mountain Baker Street.
Yes.
Oh, I see. And it's just a little grocery convenience store?
Yes.
So she got burned out.
She lost everything.
Hmm. But at least you made the effort there.
I tried.
Can you explain to us what happened on Monday? What that was all about? What did you hear from other young guys on the street? If any of them talked to you about what was going on?
What happened Monday was just a result of a lot of anger that was held in, implosion. And the implosion turned into an explosion. And what I mean by that is they were ready to implode. They had so much going on in their lives, and they didn't know what to do but to lash out. So they imploded from that.
From because of the Freddie Gray death?
It wasn't all because of the Freddie Gray death. Freddie Gray death was just the tragedy that sparked the explosion of the city.
And that explosion, when you talk about young African-American men,
yes,
mostly, who are angry about...
Angry about the situations that we are in, angry about the recs being closed down, angry about not having the resources that you see other people have, and just the next step is just exploding. Like, we're upset, and the young guys were upset because they see what they don't have, and this Freddie Gray situation just, it was just a tipping point.
I'm trying to imagine, take some guy, 28, 27 years old, and hasn't worked for a while, maybe has a prison record, can't find a job, is that typical?
That's typical in the community. Not only Sandtown community, in a lot of communities, especially with black people.
And that festers, that becomes, the anger builds from there?
It becomes anger. The anger builds from there. And what else to do but, not saying it's the right thing to do, but lash out and be noticed. And from that explosion, and it came explosion of the Baltimore City Police Department. And I'm sorry to say that it happened, but it seemed like it had to happen because now they're paying attention.
I think you can also say how many of those young men have been stopped by the police in that community. So part of the anger is they recognize what happened to Freddie Gray because it happens to them so frequently.
What happens to Freddie Gray happens to me all the time. And I get up 6 in the morning, take my nephews and stuff to school, get up and go to work, and they can just see you out there. And we're already a statistic, so everybody's a Freddie Gray in that community, so... That is angry.
Do you get eye contact with police? What happens? Do they just stop you and ask you questions?
They stop you, ask you questions. I live right on the corner of Mountain Press, man. And it's a high area of a lot of people to gather. And it's my front. And I've been approached by officers a lot of time. Y'all can't be here. Y'all have to move. And we tell them this is our property. We live here. And we'll go in the house. And then we go back and forth.
So the tension builds up.
The tension builds up.
I live
up,
here.
Yes.
I want to step out on the sidewalk. Mm-hmm. I'm going to talk to my friends, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what? You think the police think you're hustling or something?
Yeah, and that's a crazy thing. That's why the thing that we're pushing to change is our cops. Like, we need to change the community. And the way that we change the community is ourselves. And how can we try to change the community if we don't change ourselves and more leaders step up? And from that is we need to, after ourselves, we need to change the policing, the way the police interact with people. They need to have a relationship, because they're coming outside to see that they're just doing a job. But this is more than a job. If you want to connect with people in the community, you have to get to know those people in the community. And then the situations will be different. And then we have to change the policies. Like, it should be different ways that they're being trained. It should be a whole lot of topics.
Just as a citizen of Baltimore, distressed about homicides in our city and having Baltimore, you know, reported out as one of the most violent cities in America. Just as a citizen of this city, to think, well, how are we going to reduce that? How are we going to get those numbers down? How are we go back to the Fred Bielfeld, you know, strategy of bad guys with guns, focus on that, try to bring down the violent crime? I don't see how you do it unless you have a cooperation of people who live in the community and want safe streets. And if they don't trust the police, if they're worried about contact with the police, that's not going to happen. That just is illogical to me.
Yeah,
you need people who want safe streets to be cooperating with the police, correct?
And that's why, yes, we need a lot of people to step up. We need that police community and the community to step together and have a relationship so we can change that situation.
Elder Bennett said something the other day, where he said, "I have failed Freddie Gray."
Who said this?
Elder Bennett.
Elder Bennett. Oh, Antoine Bennett.
Antoine Bennett. And what he meant was is that every time we see, and until we take this attitude, that every time we see a black man suffer beyond his limits, where he has to express that in ways that are not helpful to him or the community, we ought to take that as a personal failure. And that's why we do need older black men, because we have been through stuff. I mean, I grew up in an age where you couldn't look at a police cross-eyed without getting busted upside the head. So therefore, we need to be able to talk to, as an older black man, say, wait a minute, process that anger with them. And that's where you need these older sages, if you will, in terms of men and women who've been through some things that can help them, that can mentor this younger generation.
And Marvin, you've been doing some of that.
Yes.
So you're 29. You're considered one of the older guys now.
Yeah, I'm one of the older guys.
So just briefly, what do you do with New Song?
With New Song, on Thursdays, we do a video game club. Me and myself and our youth pastor, Joe Brown. And what we do is we have kids and we have the latest video games. And I let them get into the studio, teach them a little bit about recording, let them play piano and on the drums. And we also dance and we take them out into the community basketball field right across the street. And basically, we turned our building into a rec.
How old are those kids?
These kids range from, I say, fifth grade into high school.
Boys and girls? Or
yes,
do you focus
boys
on boys?
Girls.
Boys and girls. Carol, I want to go to you back. Ooh. Since you started the show with me, Carol Recklin from Build, and we've been talking about Sandtown Winchester these whole 2 hours here. So where do we go from here? That's the question everyone's asking Baltimore about. Police community relations, about dealing with poverty, about, you know, the political system, all of it. You know,
I think there's a lot of talk about what we do as individuals, and you know, I'm going to take responsibility for the things that I do. However, I stand by what I said, that big change only happens for poor, working poor people and disenfranchised people when citizens organized to demand it. Of officials, business community, they have a role to play in this. And yesterday, Councilman Henry talked about the failure in terms of even just after-school recreation for young people. We've been fighting that fight every year for I don't know how long. And for Child First, I know how important it is for young people to have meaningful activity and engagement with them and their families and their schools. And that's what we do in Child First. So we're trying to get the city and the mayor to live to her promise to increase funding for after school programs in community schools to $10 million a year, which is a pittance for the city's budget to cover more students throughout the city. And that's important. We're also meeting about jobs and trying to move on that effort. But as I said, these things that require big change require people to continue to organize for those changes. And yes, it takes confrontation. We saw confrontation last week.
Can I ask Marvin a question following you?
Please.
Can you get some of those young guys interested in that, in the political system, or do they just want to, you know, they got to channel their energy and their thoughts someplace? And what Carol's talking about, you know, makes sense. That's how we do things in this mm-hmm. in the democratic society.
And Bill is doing some of that work too.
I mean, can you see guys doing that?
Yeah, right now.
Does it make sense to them, or do they just
guys.
Have to scream at the system, or can they actually do something like elect somebody who they support who thinks like they do? You know.
Right now, like as you said, they scream at the system because we wanted our voice heard. And now that our voices are being heard, we want part of that system now.
But Marvin is, I hate to say it, I'm not putting a lot of weight on you. He's like the leader of a young group of men. They all grew up in Sandtown. They all work together. Their families are there. And they're rational thinkers. They're mature thinkers. They understand the anger. They understand the history. They understand the abuse. But they are young men who will dialogue. So there are young men in Sandtown willing, able to dialogue with those of an older generation, with those in authority, where we can sit down and hear their voice and hear that voice very clearly. So there are men like that. And we're saying these men need to be heard. They need to be further mentored because they become the activists of tomorrow, who have a different approach in terms of how you engage this system. This is a system, and you have to engage it in a way that it understands and it listens.
You know, we're about 2 minutes away from being finished with this these 2 hours on Sandtown Winchester, and I know a lot of people in Baltimore try to remain optimistic about things and look to the future and say this could be an opportunity because we focused the whole nation's attention on Baltimore, on problems of poverty, entrenched poverty, the problem with the ex-offenders trying to return from prison and find jobs, the need for, you know, K through 12 education, getting kids started, not K through 12, even pre-K education, all those things. These are all elements here, and I think there is an opportunity, but we got to see what happens next with the political system and people pushing the political system. Right?
Absolutely. And that's work that doesn't happen in a week of protests. That's work that requires, as Reverend Wilson was saying, meeting with people one on one, getting to know them, and then giving them opportunities to take leadership in issues that affect their lives, their children's lives, and the lives of their families.
Could you see another effort being made in Sandtown?
Absolutely.
Like on the scale of the James Rouse period in the 90s?
Absolutely. And the Bill time in the 90s. I think this is the time to do that, and New Songs time. I think that the work that started needs to continue, but it needs to be big.
I'm glad you mentioned Build. I don't mean to leave Build out because Build was a big part of that. Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development. Carol Reckling served on the leadership team of Build during all these years. And she's mentioned Child First as the Child First Authority, of which she is executive director. Thank you for being here today, Carol.
Thank you, Dan.
Yeah, and also nice to get Pastor Lewis Wilson on the show with us from New Song Community Church over in Sandtown, Winchester, and part of his youth ministry there, Marvin Warfield, came in to talk with us too. Marvin, appreciate your insights and the storytelling. Thank you very much. And thank you to everybody tuned in. Yeah. Thanks, everybody. Good conversation. I hope we learned some things and expanded understanding of what goes on in Sandtown, Winchester. There's information on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, or there will be shortly, and on Twitter, about a block party coming up this weekend at what I call, what the neighbors call, Resurrection Intersection at Pressman and Pennsylvania Avenue. Over there where Elder Harris lives and not far from New Song. So that's coming up this weekend. There's some information there if you want to visit the neighborhood and get out there on Pennsylvania Avenue on Saturday. It should be a good event. So thanks for tuning in. We'll be back again tomorrow.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Aaron Morenzi, Alexis Kuhn, and Aaliyah Satterfield. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.